from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Mina Kim. Coming up on Forum, a federal judge in San Diego this week refused to dismiss a lawsuit challenging the practice of separating children from parents when they arrive at the U.S. border. Last month, Attorney General Jeff Sessions announced the administration would criminally prosecute everyone who illegally crossed the southern border, including those seeking asylum. Kids traveling with immigrants have been taken to separate detention centers, sometimes in other states. Questions are swirling around the legality and morality of this policy and its psychological impact. We look into all of this next on Forum. Join us. This is Forum. I'm Mina Kim. Does the U.S. keep immigrant children in cages, asks a Washington Post headline. That almost reads like something out of The Onion. And yet this week, Oregon's Democratic Senator Jeff Merkley said that's certainly the case. It's the latest bombshell in the uproar over the Trump administration's policy separating children from their parents at the U.S.-Mexico border. And on Wednesday, a San Diego federal judge decided to allow an ACLU lawsuit challenging the constitutionality of the policy. We take a closer look at how this zero-tolerance policy is playing out and its impact on children. We're joined by Jennifer Nagda. She's policy director at the Young Center for Immigrant Children's Rights. Good morning, Jennifer Nagda.
Good morning.
And we're also joined by Lee Gallant. He is deputy director at the ACLU Immigrants' Rights Project. Good morning, Lee Gallant.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. And I'd like to start with you, if I could. First, can you tell me briefly about both plaintiffs in this case that you have brought, challenging the constitutionality of the practice of separating parents from parents from their children?
Right. Absolutely. The first plaintiff is a woman who came from the Congo with her then 6-year-old child, made it all the way here, came to a U.S. port of entry in San Diego, so that is, presented herself to border guards at a port of entry, didn't cross, and said, I need protection. I've just escaped the Congo with my daughter. She was brought into the country, put into detention, passed her initial asylum screening interview, spent 4 days with her daughter in what was sort of like a makeshift motel detention facility. After 4 days, the guard said, we need your daughter to come into the next room. The daughter went into the next room. The mother was handcuffed and told she's going to be brought to more of a jail-type setting in San Diego, but that the daughter was going to be sent away. The next moment, she heard her daughter in the next room screaming at the top of her lungs, please don't let them take me away, mommy, please don't let them take me away. And that's the last she saw of her daughter for 4 days. She later found out that her daughter had been sent to Chicago, which meant nothing to her, and that her daughter was in a government facility in Chicago.
When you say it meant nothing to her, you mean in terms of she had no idea how far away that was?
Well, she didn't. I mean, she's from the Congo. She's a little village in the Congo. She had no idea what Chicago was, where it was, how far away it was. And she finally got to speak to her daughter. The daughter was obviously scared out of her mind. The mother was petrified, distraught. She spent 4 months in that facility in Chicago, the daughter did. The mother was in San Diego and spoke to her daughter maybe once a week, twice a week for 10 minutes. When we filed the lawsuit, the government claimed, we separated them because the mother didn't have her papers by the time she got here from the Congo, which is typical of asylum seekers who travel that far. The judge, of course, said, so you were concerned that, you know, the government said, well, we were concerned that maybe the mother was a smuggler. Well, of course, the little girl was clinging to her mother. It was obvious it was a real mother. But the judge, of course, said, well, why not do a simple DNA test? They, of course, did the DNA test then, and, of course, it was the mother. So they were finally reunited, but not after this little girl spent 4 months by herself and actually celebrated her 7th birthday all by herself in Chicago. The other named plaintiff is a Brazilian mom who got out of Brazil with her son, made it to the U.S. border, crossed between ports of entry and was prosecuted for crossing between ports of entry, crossing illegally, which is a misdemeanor. And she was then given time served a few days for the misdemeanor. In the meantime, her son was taken away and also sent to Chicago. And I think it was just coincidence that they were both sent to Chicago. The children are being sent all over the country. And so what happened was when we went to court, we said, look, for purposes of this lawsuit, we're not going to challenge the government's right to criminally prosecute asylum seekers, even though that violates the most basic fundamental principles of asylum law. And we're also not going to challenge your right to take the government's right to take the child away for the few days the mother's in jail, even though they shouldn't. But we're not going to challenge that. What we are going to challenge is once the mother leaves jail, she has to get her kid back. This mother got out of jail for the few days she served for the misdemeanor of illegal crossing, didn't get her child back for another 8 months. And so what we have said to the court is, we would like you to stop the separations, and if a parent is prosecuted, once they get out of jail, we want them immediately reunited. And what the Attorney General has said, and what Secretary Nielsen has said is, look, when people are prosecuted, they lose their child when they go to jail. What no one is pushing back on until recently with the Secretary and the Attorney General are two critical points. They are making it seem as if people's children will not be taken away if they simply go to a port of entry and don't cross illegally. And in fact, that's what they're explicitly saying. That is absolutely not true, as the story I just told you suggests, right? I mean, it shows that the Congolese mom presented herself at a port of entry legally, still had her child taken away. Another mother in our case had an 18-month-old taken away, even though she also presented herself legally at a port of entry. So it is simply not true what the secretary is saying and what the attorney general is saying, that if you don't want to lose your child, don't cross illegally. And the other point they're not saying is they're saying in America, a child doesn't come with the parent to jail. Well, maybe that's true, but in America, you get your child back when you leave jail. Like the Brazilian mom's case shows, the mom did a few days in jail for the misdemeanor of illegal crossing, but never got her son back for another 8 months.
Well, let's give a representative from the White House a chance to respond. We're joined now by Helen Furey. She's special assistant to President Trump. Good morning, Helen Furey. Helen Furey, are you there? Oh, it looks like we have unfortunately dropped the line with Helen Furey. She'll be with us in a moment. Legal alert, then I'm sure you must be pleased that this San Diego judge is allowing your case challenging the constitutionality of this practice to go forward. It's now a policy. It was a practice at the time that you filed it, I believe. But what struck you about the judge's language in terms of her decision?
Yeah, his decision. Yes, his decision was very powerful. We were thrilled with it, you know, allowing our main claim, the constitutional claim, to go forward. I think what struck me is not only sort of how tight the legal reasoning was, but how powerful the emotional response was, that, you know, calling the policy brutal and offensive, and that it shocks the conscience. I think that's critical, because at this point, given how much attention this is getting from the whole country, it's not just lawyers reading it for technical reasoning. It's, you know, the public is reading it more generally, and I think it's important for the judge to be speaking to that wider audience about what's going on and just sort of what he's feeling about it.
Well, Jennifer Nagda, you are the policy director of the Young Center for Immigrant Children's Rights, which is connected to the federal government. Can you just talk a little bit about that relationship quickly, just so we understand?
Sure. So at the Young Center, we're appointed under a federal law as the independent child advocate for unaccompanied children. And those historically have been children who come to the United States alone without a parent or a legal guardian. They either present themselves to border officials or are apprehended by border officials, and they're placed in federal custody for unaccompanied children. When we're appointed to those cases, our job is to identify and advocate for the the best interests of those children on any decision that's being made about them while they're in custody, from where they're placed to services they receive, to whether they can be released, and ultimately to whether it's in their best interest to remain in the United States if that's something they're seeking to do, or whether they can be safely repatriated. Historically, we have been appointed to work with either child trafficking victims or the most vulnerable children in federal custody. So babies and toddlers who aren't in a position to tell their own story, children with significant physical disabilities or mental illness who are also struggling to express their own opinion or tell their histories, pregnant and parenting teens, other children who have multiple issues going on in their cases and really complicated cases where it's not clear either to them or to anyone else what's in their best interests. And we are partially funded through the government to provide these services. We independently fundraise the rest and have operated 8 different sites around the country where we're appointed to these cases. But for the last year or so, we've been seeing a very different type of case, which is the one that you and Lee have been discussing today.
So when you say a very different type of case, the Trump administration has been saying that this is a continuation of an Obama-era policy. So are you saying that this is without any precedent?
At the Young Center, we have always seen kids in custody who have been taken from the adults that they arrive with. But historically, it's been because there was a legitimate question about whether or not the adult they were with was a parent or legal guardian or family member. There are legitimate cases where there are concerns that a child is being trafficked. The adult with them has no paperwork, no identifying information. But those cases are very much the exception, and they typically are grounded in some concern over the relationship between parent and child. About a year ago, when then Secretary Kelly announced that his agency was considering a policy to separate parents from children at the border to deter migration by families, that was a public statement that was followed by a pretty large outcry of opposition from the public, and the secretary backed away from a formal policy. But right around that time, we started to notice a significant increase in children arriving in shelters for unaccompanied children who had actually been taken from their parents and rendered unaccompanied by our immigration officials. So there was no question about the parent-child relationship. No one was alleging that the parent had somehow abused their child, anything that would be a legitimate basis to separate a parent from a child. And those cases continued to increase through last summer and into the fall. And then this winter, when Secretary Nielsen again refused to back away from the possibility of a blanket policy of parent-child separation, we were seeing a whole host of those cases. Since the government implemented its so-called zero-tolerance policy in May, we have noticed just a huge increase in the number of children in the facilities for unaccompanied children, and we have waiting lists in every one of our 8 offices around the country of children referred to us just on the basis of being separated from their parent at the border.
Well, we were supposed to speak with Special Assistant to President Trump, Helen Ferre, but we're having difficulty getting her back on the line. We do have tape from Acting ICE Director Thomas Homan, who spoke to someone at the Center for Immigration Studies very recently about the administration's family separation policy. And he was basically saying that they are treating the children very, very well.
They're being separated because the parent's being charged with a crime. They'll be taken in custody of U.S. Marshals. That child can't go into a U.S. Marshals facility. Children, first of all, you detain children, and at our family residential centers, there are high standards for children, educational, you know, pediatrics, all these things that are required. So HHS, according to law, has to have custody of children. So it isn't separating children just for the sake of separating them. You are prosecuting a parent. And even American citizens get separated when you prosecute a parent.
And that, again, is Acting ICE Director Thomas Homan. So he's talking about how Health and Human Services treats the children. Are you engaging with kids who are being held by Health and Human Services, essentially?
We are. By the time a child is referred to the Young Center for the Appointment of a Child Advocate, they've been taken from their parent. The parent remains behind in federal custody, whether it's Department of Homeland Security custody or U.S. Marshals custody, and the child is transferred to the Department of Health and Human Services.
And that's where you intercept them. But I'm just curious if you would agree with Homan's characterization.
It was interesting to hear him say those things. I would point out that the high standards that are in place are not the result of the government simply stepping up and doing that. They're the result of years, in fact, decades of litigation by children and parents activists to get some basic standards of care into the facilities where either parents and children are held together or the facilities where children are held. The Department of Health and Human Services, which under law takes custody of unaccompanied children, has an obligation to place children in the least restrictive environment that's in their best interests. And so these children are coming into shelters where there are a host of individuals to care for them, but because they have just been ripped from their parent, and in the example Lee provided, without notice, without preparation, usually in the cases we've heard of, under false circumstances, you'll see your mom in a minute, don't worry, you'll see your dad soon. The children are devastated, I would say as devastated or more so than their parents. It's very hard for them to understand what's going on, just as a mother may not understand. A mother from the Congo may not know where and what Chicago is. Neither do these children understand where they are or where their parents are or have any understanding of when they might be reunited. And as we know from study after study, the vast majority of families coming here are doing so after fleeing circumstances of extraordinary violence in home countries. So they have already experienced something pretty awful and terrible. I know a lot of the parents do their best to protect their children from that, but I think a lot of the children are aware that they are coming from situations of extraordinary violence that motivated their parents to leave everything and everyone they know and migrate in order to try and find safety. And so when you layer onto that the trauma of being ripped away from the one adult who has been your safety net, the person who cares for you and provides for you, for the young children, the one adult they are attached to, which is so developmentally important. I'm not sure there's any level of care that could really replace the care of a parent.
Lee Gallant, are you trying to get in here? I was just curious because I could hear you.
Yeah, I would like to actually add on to what Jennifer was saying and respond to what Mr. Homan said. I think there's three points that are critical, a couple of that I've made before, but I just want to reiterate. First of all, he's saying we take the kid away if the parent is prosecuted for illegal entry. Well, the government is never admitting that they take kids away even when the parent presents themselves legally at a port of entry, as our Congolese plaintiff did. And so that's one thing. Right there, the statement he's making simply is misleading. The second point is he's saying, well, anytime a mother is criminally prosecuted in America, the child doesn't come along to the jail. What he's not saying is that anytime a mother is criminally prosecuted, when she gets out of jail, she gets her child back. They are not giving the children back once the parent gets out of jail. They also could just keep the child near the jail for the couple of days the parent is in jail. But even if they're not going to do that, they need to reunite. And the third point is just what Jennifer was saying. The harm comes not from the care the kids are receiving, although, as Jennifer will say, the shelters are being overwhelmed with sheer numbers and how young the kids are. It comes from the mere fact of separation. We put an enormous amount of medical testimony in court from doctors, experts all over the country, saying it's the fact of separation that causes the trauma, likely permanent trauma. Not the care can be as good as you want to give it at the facility, but the separation. And the reason is just sort of in very simple lay terms is when you're a 3-year-old, a 4-year-old, a 5-year-old, you look to your parent as the protector, and you feel like your parent is all-powerful and can protect you from the world. Once you see with your own eyes that a parent cannot protect you, that sense of vulnerability will last your whole lifetime. These little 3-, 4-, and 5-year-olds are being taken away screaming. They're seeing their parents standing there in handcuffs, helpless to help them, you know, to do anything about it. And that's what is going through their brain and triggering this trauma. And what the doctors are saying is it's going to likely last a lifetime, that kind of vulnerability.
Well, what do you say to the federal government and representatives of the federal government who say, look, if you don't want to go through this, don't come to this country? Lee Gallant.
Yeah. I mean, look, first of all, most of these women are asylum seekers. We have an obligation under U.S. law and international law to take asylum seekers. But there's this sort of no choice but to come under the law that they have to be allowed. But it's also, you can't say to a mother who's trying to protect her child from a gang, maybe be killed, don't come. I mean, she's just between a rock and a hard place. We've asked our clients, would you have come anyway if you knew your child was going to be taken away? And they just shrug and say, what choice did I have? I can't leave my child to potentially be tortured or killed or me killed in those countries. But there's also another point I think is worth making. So, I mean, that point is that it doesn't work as a deterrent. But I think, you know, another point is, what if it even did work as a deterrent? I mean, I'm sure there's certain things we could do, take away water and food from the child, that could conceivably act as a deterrent. But at some point in a civilized society, you say, let's have some perspective, let's have some proportionality, and let's not do something that's just so inhumane, even if we think it might have a deterrent effect, which this doesn't. So, you know, at some point, and I think that's what the administration didn't plan on, is the outrage from both the left and the right. What we are seeing is that this is not cutting along normal immigration lines. A lot of people do not agree with the ACLU's larger immigration stances. But what we are seeing is even people who don't agree with those larger immigration stances that we take are saying, but on this, enough is enough. We cannot go to sleep at night knowing that there are 3-, 4-, and 5-year-old kids just sitting all by themselves in facilities separated from their parents.
Forgive me for interrupting, but we do have a spokesperson from the Department of Justice on the line, Devin O'Malley. Hello, Devin O'Malley.
Hey, how are you?
I'm well. Thanks for joining us. I want you to respond to Lee Gelernt's point earlier that kids are being separated even at ports of entry.
So I've seen reports of that. I'm not able to confirm that here, but you know, as in terms of what was just referenced, you know, I can respond by saying that the criminal laws of illegal entry have been on the books for decades. They've been enforced for decades, and when a criminal prosecution happens,
but even in the case, forgive me, Devin O'Malley, but even in the case of asylum seekers.
So, thank you for bringing that up. After the criminal prosecution process runs its course, those illegal aliens are turned back over to ICE custody, and they are able to go through the credible fear process. So they still have that opportunity to seek asylum, as you say.
Why aren't kids being returned quickly in this case that the ACLU has brought forward? There was 4 months of waiting, 8 months of waiting for another woman?
The federal government actually has to deal with a number of different consent decrees and laws that require the transfer of custody of children. And so depending on when criminal prosecution happens or, you know, that custody happens, it oftentimes delays the reunification process. So that would be one scenario where that would happen.
We're about to go to a break, but is this zero tolerance policy, where you're hearing descriptions of it inflicting trauma on kids, worth it if, as we're hearing, it's not deterring people from coming to the border?
Well, let me answer that. There's a couple of different things there.
And we just have 20 seconds.
Yeah, well, one, the process of the zero tolerance policy has already, you know, been in effect for about 3 weeks. So when you talk about a deterrent effect, it's very hard to measure that. There was an LA Times report where one gentleman said that he was going to cross the river, but heard that we were prosecuting everybody, so he chose not to. And I'd just like to say that children in HHS custody have great care. They have access to medical care, dental care.
Devin O'Malley, we have to get to a break. Just hang on. This is Forum. I'm Mina Kim. We're looking at the Trump administration's zero-tolerance policy when it comes to immigrants illegally crossing or seeking asylum at the U.S.-Mexico border. Last month, Attorney General Jeff Sessions directed the Justice Department to criminally prosecute anyone who illegally crosses. And also, kids traveling with those immigrants are now being taken to different detention facilities from their parents, sometimes in other states. We're joined by Devin O'Malley, who is a spokesperson from the Department of Justice. So we'll take your questions after we speak with Devin O'Malley, who needs to leave us in just a couple minutes. Devin O'Malley, please finish the point you were making just before we went to break.
Let me try to regain my thoughts and remember where I was. We were discussing the level of care that goes into these HHS facilities. I believe that HHS has about $1 billion budget for these HHS facilities, where, you know, meals, snacks, medical care, dental care, ability to exercise, I believe, access to psychologists, all goes into these facilities, and the children in the HHS facilities have access to this.
Well, before I let you go, Devin, could you please help me understand why they cannot be held together, why children cannot be held with their parents?
That's a very good question. When a family unit crosses the border illegally, and the adult family member is taken into U.S. Marshals custody to be placed in criminal prosecution proceedings, a child cannot go. This is irrespective of immigration status. This happens all around the country every day. A child cannot go with their parent into a criminal detention facility. So if they did, what people are suggesting is that we keep children and parents together, which the marshals are not authorized to do. But if we did, we'd be exposing to children to potentially violent offenders, murderers, rapists in these criminal detention facilities.
But instead, why then send them thousands of miles potentially away to Chicago, say, if they're crossing in California?
Because they're placed in HHS care where there aren't potentially violent offenders like murderers and rapists. They're placed in HHS care where they're given all the things that I just mentioned. So that's the option here that it seems like our critics are giving us, is to place them in a criminal detention facility, which, one, isn't allowed by law, and expose them to violent criminals so they can stay with their parents, or place them in HHS care where the ultimate goal is reunification.
Or the other being whether or not to criminally prosecute them if they're seeking asylum. Well, Devin O'Malley,
we have laws in this country that we need, that if we don't enforce, it sends a message to people. That's what happened in the last administration. They attempted to find ways around prosecuting the crimes that Congress gave us, and it didn't work. That's why we have a crisis on the border. There were catch and release, prosecutorial discretion. All these things didn't work, and that's why we have a crisis at the border right now. So we are attempting to enforce the laws that Congress gave us and that have been on the books for decades. And just because prior administrations chose not to enforce the law doesn't make it improper to restore the rule of law at the Southwest border.
Devin O'Malley, a spokesperson for the U.S. Department of Justice, thanks again for joining us.
Thank you for giving me the opportunity.
And we are joined now by two others. We have Nick Miroff with us. He's the national security reporter from The Washington Post. Hello, Nick Miroff. Hi, Nick Miroff. Are you there? Looks like we may have lost that line. Let's see if Jeff Merkley is with us, the U.S. Senator representing Oregon. And Jeff Merkley is not with us, I understand. Jeff Merkley, are you there? And we're having some trouble with our phones today. My apologies. Let me go back to Lee Gellert for a reaction to Devin O'Malley. Lee Gellert?
I mean, what I think you heard is a non-response to your question and to what I was saying, right? So he is saying, well, when they go to jail, I mean, we can argue forever about whether they should be prosecuting asylum seekers. They shouldn't. They're not a deterrent. It's inhumane. But let's just take everything he said as a given, that they can prosecute asylum seekers and that the child can't come into the marshal service, into an actual jail with the parent. The parent is only there for a few days because it's a misdemeanor. What you never heard him address, not once, is why don't they give the child back when the parent leaves jail? They are not giving the parent back. He had no answer for that. They had no answer in court. All they kept saying is, well, the child can't come to criminal jail. Okay, so we're accepting that for purpose of this lawsuit. Why are they not giving the child back?
Well, William asks, how was this handled during the Obama years? Was it significantly differently, Glart? I mean, you've been doing this work for 25 years, right? You've
right.
seen a lot.
Yeah, I mean, this is as horrific as any practice I've seen in 25-plus years of doing civil rights work in the immigration area. what this is unprecedented. This is absolutely a Trump administration policy. It's not required by any other law. If it was, other administrations would do it. What Jennifer said is right. You saw a smattering of cases only where it was absolutely necessary. There was no widespread practice, no policy. And I think the easiest way to sum it up is, in prior administrations, those administrations did everything possible to keep a parent and child together. This administration is doing everything they can to retroactively justify all these separations. So in the case of the Congolese mom, there was no doubt that she was the mom. But then the administration comes in after 4 months. We know the reason they did it is they believe it deters people from coming here to seek asylum. But then in court, they tried to justify it by saying, well, we weren't really sure they were the little girl's mom was who she was saying. I mean, what little girl is screaming and clinging, please, mommy, don't let them take me away? But plus, they could have just done a DNA test. That's the real difference. The presumption now, the practice is we're going to take all the kids away. In prior administrations, it happened so infrequently, only where it was absolutely necessary for some particular reason.
Well, Legal Earned, I know we need to let you go as well. Deputy Director of the ACLU Immigrants' Rights Project, thanks for joining us this morning. I appreciate it.
Oh, thanks for having me.
And let me remind our listeners who is with us. We have Jennifer Nagda on the line, Policy Director for the Young Center for Immigrant Children's Rights. And we'd like to invite you to join the conversation. What are your thoughts on this practice, on this policy? Do you support it, the White House rationale for it, or are you concerned? The number is 866-733-6786. Again, 866-733-6786. Post your comments on our website, kqed.org/forum. On Facebook, you can tweet us at kqedforum. Or email us at forum@kqed.org. Michael writes, would you agree with the notion that the bedrock of Trump administration seems to be drawing false equivalents? Are the criminal laws so rigid that it can't distinguish asylum seekers from child abusers? Jeff Merkley, U.S. Senator representing Oregon, is on the line, I believe. Good morning, Senator Merkley.
Good morning. It's great to be with you.
Thanks for joining us. One of the reasons that we have you on the line is because you made quite an assertion that you are seeing children in cages in McAllen, Texas, when you visited an immigrant processing center there. What did you see?
This is not different from in the past, but that's what they look like. The press hasn't been admitted, so they want to know, what does it look like in there? Well, it's fence posts and it's cyclone fencing. It looks like a cage, or it looks like a dog kennel. But that is not really the point. The point is that what happens in the next room over, which is where children are separated from their parents. And so you have a very large enclosure, a bigger enclosure of fencing, and in that are all these young boys, for example. And I just stood outside this fencing looking in, and these kids were lining up to get food, and from the youngest to the oldest, and the youngest was just knee-high to a grasshopper, maybe only 4 or 5 years old, on then up through 16 or 17 years old. And the thing that strikes you is that in the past there would be a small number of unaccompanied minors, but now there's this large number inside that enclosure because they're tearing away the kids from their parents for the families seeking asylum.
Well, Jeff,
great trauma to these kids.
Jeff Merkley, what is the HELP Act that you are proposing?
Well, the act is an act that Senator Feinstein is putting forward, and I'm supporting, that says that you cannot take the kids away from their parents when they're seeking asylum. This would restore the practice that every administration has had. We're a nation of immigrants, and we have never been in the situation of treating immigrants seeking asylum who are fleeing persecution abroad as if they are criminals. But that is what this administration has chosen to do.
And why are you also pushing for a bill that would allow members of Congress like you to visit any detention facility? I know you were denied entry into a detention facility in Brownsville, Texas, that you be given access within 24 hours as opposed to the 2 weeks that they're saying that senators get now.
Yeah, so the situation is that after the kids are separated from their parents, they're sent off to who knows where. But one of those places is big warehouses. So I went to visit this former Walmart that is holding hundreds of kids. I was told by some advocates there might be 1,000 kids inside that Walmart. at kind of a bit of an irony that it's named Casa Padre, meaning the house of your father, because there's no parents there, just kids. And I asked official permission to go in. They said, no, it'd be weeks, and we're not sure we'd even grant it then. And so I said, well, I'm down visiting these other facilities. I'll just go by and say, you know, show my ID, say I'm a U.S. senator, say I think it's important to be able to see what's going on. Can you just walk me through the facility? And the supervisor walked me through. And the secretary, when I called up from the front door, because they had a number posted on the front door because it's a locked facility, said, okay, yeah, the supervisor will come out and talk to you. And so I thought, well, great. But the supervisor didn't come out. And for 10 minutes, I called again. Then the supervisor comes out only after the police arrived that they had summoned, because they did not want a U.S. senator to be knocking on their door. And this was pretty striking, because this strategy of saying you need 2 weeks' notice and then we're not sure we can grant it is designed to make it very difficult for members of Congress to schedule the opportunity to see what's going on. And if they do get scheduled, they have weeks to prepare to put on a show for you that wouldn't reflect the way things happen on a day-to-day basis. And so we need members of Congress to be able to see what's happening on a day-to-day basis. These kids who, if there are 1,000 kids crowded in there, well, that's incredible. But these are kids, many with trauma from overseas, trauma from being separated from their parents. If they don't have the resources they need, then we can help advocate for those resources. But we have to see what's going on. And meanwhile, we need to shine a light on the fact that these kids are being ripped away from their parents, totally, totally hurting them. And we don't do that. No moral code justifies hurting kids to influence their parents. No religious code justifies that.
Oregon U.S. Senator Jeff Merkley, thank you for joining us this morning.
You're welcome. Thank you very much.
Carl tweets, we have become that country. The stench will stick a long time. The Statue of Liberty now holds a warning signal high, where it used to be a beacon of hope and refuge. Jim says, cruel and unusual punishment. We're joined now by Nick Miroff, I believe, national security reporter for The Washington Post. Nick Miroff, are you there?
I'm here, Mina. Good to be with you, and sorry for the technical challenges.
Oh, no, that's all right. I understand that you've looked at the numbers, and I just want to get a sense of how many kids we're potentially talking about who've been separated from their families, because there are also kids, as I understand it, who are unaccompanied as well. So can you just give us a clearer sense of the scope of what we're dealing with right now?
Yeah, I mean, keep in mind these are just sort of estimates, but I can tell you that about 5 months ago there were 6,400 kids in HHS custody. I think we can assume most of those were what the government calls unaccompanied minors who arrived without a parent or relative. As of April 30th, that number was up to about 8,800. And then what we saw in May, as the Trump administration really began to put their zero-tolerance approach in full force, we saw that number go up from about 8,800 to nearly 11,000. So that's about, you know, an increase of about more than 2,000 children in the span of 30 days. And it's safe to say that a large number of those are probably kids who have been separated from their parents.
And in terms of shelter capacity, which you have also written about, do we have the capacity to take in these large numbers?
We do now. You know, what happened in 2014 was that there was that surge of unaccompanied minors and families coming over, and our listeners will probably remember the images from then of kind of overflowing Border Patrol stations and shelters. Since then, the government has really kicked it into high gear and, like, you know, allocated significantly more money to have this type of capacity. So the latest from HHS is that they're about 95% capacity, but they can rapidly add a couple thousand more beds. But, you know, again, it's that involves bringing on board online some kind of larger facilities. There's one apparently down in Homestead, Florida, that was recently used for a Labor Department Job Corps fair. And the thinking is that they can, you know, quickly retrofit that to have hundreds, if maybe, you know, even as many as 1,000 beds to accommodate these kids. And as you heard from the senator, there's this other very large facility down there in Brownsville that's in a former Walmart. So these are, you know, not exactly intimate group home type settings.
Well, let's go to our callers. Deborah in Concord, what's your question?
My question is really more of a comment. You know, I mean, I work for the immigrant community in Concord. I am part of the Stand Together COCO Rapid Response Network. We have had cases that have come through where children have been separated from their parents at the border, where a mother has been sent to Contra Costa, children to Texas, and the grandmother in that case to somewhere back east. And it takes, in order to get any kind of legal representation, you have to know where all the parties are. And that information is not transparent and not easy to find. But more than anything, what I really wanted to mention was the effect of this separation and trauma on early child development. There's tons of research about how it can reduce the brain cortex, and that's what we are doing to children. It's bad enough that we're separating families, but to treat children like animals and to not think that there's going to be long-term effects on this, I think, is deeply egregious.
Well, Deborah, thanks for the comment. Jennifer Nagda, as an entity that provides federal guardians for kids, can you recommend that it's in the best interest of kids to be reunified with their parents immediately? Since you're advocating for them and they're supposed to follow your recommendations, right, at least in a large majority of the cases.
Well, the federal law allows us to be appointed and to make our recommendations, and we do so consistent with state and federal law. The federal government has found that our recommendations are frequently and quite frequently followed, but they are not obligated to follow our recommendations. I wish they were. But I think your listeners have pointed out two really good points. One is just the fundamental unfairness of the system, and the second is the complication of reunification, and that gets to the question that you just raised, Mina. But on the unfairness point, when the parents are separated from their children, then they're rushed over to their criminal cases where they're charged with a misdemeanor, and they're asked to make extraordinarily important decisions about whether they plead to the misdemeanor, whether they try and contest the case. Minutes, if not, or hours, if not minutes, from when they've been separated from their child. And then they get returned to their immigration proceeding. And whether or not the parents are charged criminally, they will always be charged and placed into immigration proceedings, which, again, gets to the absurdity of a system where now every parent is being charged with a misdemeanor that causes the separation just to come back into the immigration system where they have to go through a whole case, but they have to decide whether to try and fight their case while they're separated from their child without knowing where their child is, without knowing if or when they'll be able to contact their child, without knowing if they decide to go back, will they be able to go back with their child? And that gets to your question and the point of complication. In most of these cases, the parents and children desperately want to be together. And if the parent wants to stay and fight the case because they are so afraid of what's waiting for them in home country, then we have to find alternatives for the children. So that there are places for them to go while the parent fights their case. In other cases, the parents either don't have an opportunity to fight and are simply ordered deported, and then we're fighting like crazy to get the children to be able to return with their parents when that's what both the child and the parent wants. And it's a very difficult thing to do because our systems weren't set up to accommodate these situations. So there's no mechanism, as your caller just pointed out, for children to communicate with their parents in detention. At the Young Center, we can spend weeks trying to find the parent, and the parents are being transferred around constantly, and then making arrangements for the parent to speak with the child. And if you have an officer who isn't interested or who is too busy, or you can't find somebody who speaks the right language, it can be very difficult to set those calls up on the parent's end. Although I will say on the child's end, the facilities are very anxious to facilitate contact between parents and children, but it is a logistical nightmare, and that doesn't end anytime soon.
Well, let's go next to Marjorie in Berkeley. Join us, Marjorie.
Thank you. I'd like to speak from my memory of what it was like to be a child separated for months from my parents when I was 3 and 4. My parents were wealthy Republicans. We college graduates, but polio made the hospitalization necessary, best of care. But I woke last night screaming in memory of that time because no young child can understand why their parents have left them, or whether they'll be safe, even under the best circumstances. I want to support the law that says no child should be separated from their parents. Let them, they want to build facilities where they can be together. Also, I was at Yale Graduate School of Nursing, and at the time, there was such recognition that this was a lifetime trauma, that they were changing everything so that there were facilities where families could be with children that had to be hospitalized for more than a day or two.
Well, Marjorie, thank you for sharing.
We can't go back.
Thank you for sharing your story. Nick Miroff, you are concerned that, or you are reporting at least, right, that there could be a further increase in the number of children in federal custody and the length of time that they stay separated from their parents because of a new agreement between Health and Human Services and the Department of Homeland Security. Can you describe that?
Yeah. So in the past, you know, the thinking was that information, you know, when a child is in HHS custody, HHS begins to look for a sponsor. In many cases, that is a relative of the child. In about half the cases, that is one of the child's parents. Now, the thinking in the past has been that that information provided by those sponsors, many of whom are not in the country legally, that that information should be kind of walled off from ICE and from other DHS agencies, because it shouldn't be used for enforcement purposes. Well, now there's a new agreement between DHS and HHS that will allow DHS agencies to access that information that is provided by potential sponsors for the children. DHS says that its goal is to protect the children, to make sure they're not going into the hands of traffickers or people who would do them wrong. But the concern is that there will be a chilling effect, and that once potential sponsors know that by stepping forward to try to claim that child, they could jeopardize their own legal status in the, or their own status in the country, then that could end up leaving far more children in long-term HHS care. And I'll just add that, you know, one of the things that the government has said about this is, well, any parent, you know, that isn't willing to step forward to get their child doesn't, you know, deserve to have their child. The complication enters when you're talking about a relative, say an aunt or an uncle, who may be in the country with their own family. They may be here illegally. They may not have seen this child or know this child. They haven't seen them in years. And, you know, asking them to jeopardize their whole family's American lives in order to claim this child may end up being a stretch. And so, yes, the fear is that there could be significantly more children who just don't get picked up.
Well, Jordan tweets, who is paying for this and who is profiting? Is the taxpayer paying for this? Nick Miroff, do you have any insights into that?
Yeah. So HHS has increased its budget to well over $1 billion. And some of the largest grantees, these are for-profit companies that provide shelter for these children. Some of these companies have contracts to the tune of tens, if not over $100 million. One of the largest is the Southwest Key, who runs the shelter that Senator Merkley tried to visit. And I believe they have secured more than $200 million in federal contracts to provide these services over the last several years.
Well, let's go to more phone calls. Danny in Oakland. Hi, Danny.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for the show and thank you for your guests. In the spirit of our own judicial system here in the United States that I'm accustomed with, when a parent commits a crime and there's no family to take care of their child, we have like a foster system, or what I would think of as like, you know, basically a sponsor family. Why do we have these children in cages when there's so many people in this country who are so deeply affected by this, you know, situation? Why can't these children be placed somewhere where there's a family that can keep up with what's going on with their parents, keep them in school, have some sort of normalization going on, and indeed not have them caged and treated like animals when, in fact, they're not even criminals, even though, you know, we're talking about this as though it's a criminal matter?
Well, according to Jeff Sessions in a recent interview with conservative radio host Hugh Hewitt, he said that we don't want to do this at all. If people don't want to be separated from their children, they should not bring them with them. Danny, thank you for your point. And
can I just respond to that?
Yes,
quickly?
Nick Miroff.
Yeah, I do want to clear up the misconception that, that children are kept like in cages for any longer amount of time. The whole purpose of the HHS system is to get children as quickly as possible out of DHS custody, in which they are in detention facilities, and into what are basically shelters or foster care. And the children who are in long-term HHS custody are often going to foster care homes or group homes. Jennifer would know far more about that, but I don't want the listeners to come away with the impression that we have children in cages for weeks or months on end.
Well, and Jennifer Nagda, we're repeatedly getting these questions around asylum seekers and people who are crossing the border illegally. Dawn asks, I've heard that immigration offenses like crossing the border or being in the U.S. without papers are civil rather than criminal. Another listener says, seeking asylum and illegally crossing a border are not the same thing. Why are they characterized as the same thing? Is this the case? And are you seeing the children of asylum seekers, at HHS facilities?
Absolutely. So HHS has a system that is set up, as your caller pointed out, to provide shelter care and family care and kinship care and community care to truly unaccompanied children. What we've seen in the last year, and especially in the last couple of months, is that by separating children from their parents and rendering them unaccompanied, we have taken the children of asylum-seeking families and placed them into a system that was designed for children who are alone. And I think the idea that parents traveling thousands of miles, fleeing persecutors in their home country, would know to go to an exact location to ask for help rather than to ask for help the minute they see someone, to turn themselves into a Border Patrol agent and still be charged as if they had done something wrong because they didn't know the exact spot to show up and make that same request. It just demonstrates the absurdity and the unfairness of the approach that the federal government is taking with these families and children.
Jennifer Nagda, Policy Director at the Young Center for Immigrant Children's Rights, and Nick Miroff, National Security Reporter for The Washington Post. Thanks to both of you for joining us this morning. My name is Mina Kim. This is Forum, and I appreciate our listeners joining us with their questions and comments.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.